Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Support for WPR comes from Amplify Health. The doctors, clinics, and hospitals of Gunderson Health System and Bellin Health have come together to form Amplify Health. AmplifyHealth.org. A little empathy changes everything.
Thanks for joining us today on WPR News, and I want to welcome you to another meeting of our Larry Miller Show Book Club. So glad you could make it. We're talking today about the novel The Killer's Terms, and with me in the studio, the author, Kevin Kleesner, and he's here to answer your questions and talk about the book and talk about writing and a whole lot more. He's a graduate of Marquette University. He's been an outdoor writer for a daily newspaper. He was a teacher, a hospital administrator, and, of course, an author. He might be the only person who is a member of the American College of Healthcare Executives and the International Thriller Writers. And he lives in New Berlin, Wisconsin. And as we talk with him, I want to hear from you. Did you read The Killer's Terms? Or have you read any of the Cole Hipsch novels? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Kevin Kleesner, welcome. Thanks for joining in today.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks so much for having me.
I really enjoyed your book. And maybe just to start, what's the story about for those who haven't read it? I mean, I know there are a lot of people who've read it who are listening, but there are also probably more that haven't. So give us a rundown.
Sure. So the Cole Hipsch series is a thriller series. And it's along the lines of, let's say, the John Sanford, Lucas Davenport series. And it's set in the Twin Cities. This follows Cole Hipsch, who's an FBI agent, special agent in charge of the Milwaukee, Wisconsin field office. And that puts him in charge of kind of all the FBI activity in Wisconsin. And there's I'll call it a dual protagonist, and that's Michelle Fields. And Michelle Fields is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So these two basically get together, and they were thrown together in the first book, and they have to work together to solve crimes.
But they fall in love, too.
Well, they might. Yes, they do. And it's funny. You know, you write a series like this, and you never know where it's going to go when you start out with the first one. But in the first book, they had a lot of issues that they had to get through. And there's one thing that I believe, Larry, that we've lost in society today, and that's the ability to have civil discourse where, you know, we're so divided. And in my books, the protagonists in particular maintain respect, even though they might have disagreements about different things.
Yeah, it's and that can be tough to do.
It can be.
Yeah, especially if you have your own strong opinions. You have the book involves the attempt. It starts with the attempted murder of Michelle,
right?
And along the way, sort of solving that issue, and a lot of other issues come up that I want to talk about with you as we go along today. But you have an excerpt. Do you have an excerpt that we can just start with?
Sure.
From the book? To give people an idea for those who haven't read?
Yeah, no, and I'll just see if I can tee this up. So this starts in the first book. I need to share this.
Yeah.
There were reproductive health physicians were being targeted for murder. And Michelle and Cole basically had to work together to solve those murders and put an end to it. And in the subsequent books, she writes, based on her experience as a journalist, she writes a true crime book on that experience, which she calls The Killer's Sermon. And that coincidentally is the name of my first novel. But anyway, so this opening chapter, and I'll kind of jump into the middle of it. But in the opening chapter, she's getting ready to do an author talk at the Milwaukee Public Library. So here we go. She took a deep breath and held the warm September air in her lungs, feeling the kiss of the early autumn sun on her face. She smiled when she turned to look up at the main entrance of the library, which spanned the entire city block. Its stoic gray Bedford limestone walls rose 3 stories above a raised basement. It was a far cry from her hometown library. She'd grown up on her parents' dairy farm outside Wabino, Wisconsin, an hour and a half north of Green Bay, and over 3 hours away from where she currently stood. The Wabino Public Library was a tiny log cabin built in 1897 and converted into the town library nearly 100 years ago. Her mom drove her to the library every week until Michelle was old enough to ride her bike into town, the white plastic wicker handlebar basket filled with stories to broaden the mind and imagination of a young girl. She looked at the mammoth building in front of her again. This was a different library altogether. Less than a year ago, Michelle was a general assignment reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It was exciting work when she first started right out of college. But by the time she turned 35, she felt like she was still writing stories that nobody would remember beyond the next day. That all changed when she covered the murders of reproductive health physicians, and the killer reached out to her repeatedly via email. Michelle helped the FBI track down the killer, and after he died in a shootout with law enforcement, Michelle took a sabbatical from reporting duties to write a true crime thriller about the murders. She received a large advance, and now the widely anticipated book sat atop the New York Times and other bestseller lists a week after its release. Michelle smiled. Heady stuff for a Wabino farm girl. She pushed through the middle set of large wooden double doors and entered the library's 3-story marble pillared atrium. It took her breath away. To her right was the Wisconsin Writers' Wall of Fame, and she marveled at the list of names, including legends like Aldo Leopold, John Muir, Carl Sandburg, Laura Ingalls Wilder, John Thornton Wilder, and Orson Welles. She also recognized David Marinus, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who grew up in Madison before going on to a long and legendary career with the Washington Post. Meeting him in high school had helped steer Michelle to her own career in journalism and to the place she stood right now. And there was no place she'd rather be.
Oh, it gives us a great introduction to her, where she's from, kind of what she stands for a little bit. But you know that there's fireworks, kind of, so to speak, are on the way.
Well, you know, they say it's always darkest before the dawn, and sometimes when you're at your peak is when something comes around in life that drops you very low, right? And so, obviously, she's at the pinnacle of something right here, and she's feeling great about it.
And you knew something was coming, and it made for... It made for a really great introduction to me because I knew what was coming. I learned about her, and I already feel good about her, you know. But I know that there's harm on the way.
It's funny because I was thinking about this just the other day, and it reminded me this scene in the first. It's almost like Mary Tyler Moore when she comes to. I think it was it Minneapolis?
Yeah.
And she throws her hat up in the air, and she's so happy to be there. I don't know, I want people to feel deeply about the characters.
Yeah.
And obviously I invest some time in that. But the other thing about this chapter, which runs through to my work, is it describes a little bit about something in Wisconsin that I think those of us from Wisconsin love to hear about, and I think people who live outside of here, it's any novel like this, I think the first thing ought to be you're trying to entertain readers.
Yeah.
But if they can learn something while they read it, that's better.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. You know, Denise in Waukesha has a question for you. Let's go there.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you, Larry, for this wonderful show. I love listening to your program.
Thank you.
And especially when you bring on authors, it's always fun. You know, they say you can't judge a book by its cover. And I think in Kevin's case, you can, because his covers are hauntingly really beautiful and moody. You know, the first one in color and the next two in black and white. So my question is to Kevin, can you share your intentions behind your book cover choices?
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah, go ahead. You know what? Denise, I had the same question in my head, but so go ahead, Kevin.
Well, great. And Denise, thanks for calling in. I really appreciate it. And I love to talk about this, and I'll tell you why. When I signed my deal, I signed a 3-book contract with my publisher, Level Best Books. And, you know, I was going to be a debut author at 63. So I had zero leverage. And I read the contract, and that contract said they had basically the final say over every word and every image. I mean, it was all theirs. And so when the first book came out, they gave me 3 different covers to choose from. And, you know, I didn't know. None of them meant anything to me. And I shared them with friends and beta readers. And basically it all came back a third, a third, a third. And so I just said to my publisher, just pick. You guys know this business better than I do. With my second book, you know, the first one did pretty well for them. I got, you know, a little bit of moxie, and I have 3 grown children. One of them has his degree in fine arts, and he's an amazing artist. He was just commissioned to do the opening day poster for the Milwaukee Brewers. So, you know, anyway, I asked him, I said, there's no guarantee that my publisher will use it, but would you please, I've got this scene in the second book. It was set at Atwater Park in Shorewood, Wisconsin, the scene on the cover. And it actually is a scene from the book, but it shows a piece of sculpture. And that sculpture really sits there, and it's kind of moody looking out over Lake Michigan. And so I asked my son if he would design a cover based on that. So he painted it. And then did the cover, and my publisher said, we love it. And so they went with that. And with this one, there's a scene that takes place at Marquette University it's called the St. Joan of Arc Chapel. And that chapel was built originally in the early 1400s. It was built in France. And legend has it that St. Joan of Arc, when she was 17, prayed there before a big victory against the English. And so, long story short, they moved that chapel originally, I think, in the early 1900s to New York.
Brick by brick,
stone, stone by stone. And then it was moved in the early 1960s to Marquette University's campus. And it's just this little, beautiful chapel. And I'm sure it's the oldest building in Wisconsin. But it's also kind of the heart of Marquette University. And it's one of those places where I would go as an undergrad if I had a crisis in confidence or conscience or even faith. And I would find myself there, and it would help me center myself. And so to be able to use that cover, you know, in my cover, to be able to basically have a collaboration with my son, whose name happens to be Cole. It's just one of the great fun things of this author journey.
And the publisher loved that one as well then,
absolutely. Absolutely. Didn't make a change. And what's nice now is I feel like it's almost as an author and your books, if you can have kind of a brand, just like a business, it's a good thing. And so my last 2 books, I think, have a very common look and feel.
Yeah. Denise?
Yes.
That help you out?
It sure does. Thank you so much, and best of luck with your books. They're really wonderful. I thoroughly enjoy them.
Oh, thank you, Denise.
Thanks, Denise.
You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can email the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. At noon today, we'll talk about Earth Fest. It's a week-long event celebrating environmental and sustainability research at UW-Madison. And at 12:30, we'll talk with a Rhinelander shoe repairman who's been in the business for more than 50 years. Looking forward to those, but also looking forward to continuing my conversation with Kevin Kleisner. And it's the Larry Mueller Show Book Club book for this segment, and it's titled The Killer's Terms. Questions or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number to call again, 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Back to the title for just a minute, because I noted in the title, The Killer's Terms, that the apostrophe was after the S.
Well, we had more than one killer, so. But it's funny, I've had a number of people point that out to me. It's good.
Barbara in Cross Plains has something for us. Barbara, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much, WPR, for this great stuff you do, like telling us about great authors and great books. I'm a daily reader. I belong to book clubs, and I was born and raised in the Midwest with ties to Wisconsin and Minnesota and all of the states. So I'm always drawn to the authors and settings. And you really introduced me to another great one by having me read this book. And I just want to say thank you. I enjoyed how you created suspense. You fully fleshed out your characters, and you really handled present-day political and law enforcement intrigue, really. And just a small caveat, thanks for having the scene at the St. Joan of Arc Chapel. I spent time there when our daughter was a student and graduated at Marquette. So that really meant a little bit extra, too, personally.
Barbara, thanks for calling. Comment, Kevin?
Thanks. All I can say is thanks, Barbara. I'll tell you, it takes a lot to write a book. It takes probably even more to find a publisher. And then to get out, put yourself out there and promote the book. And the biggest joy I get out of that is connecting with readers. And when you say things like that, I can't tell you how much that motivates me to be a better author.
Yeah, thank you.
So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. I wanted to turn to healthcare for just a minute. As I briefly mentioned earlier, you had a career in healthcare before becoming an author, and a lot of scenes in the book take place in the hospital, and the administrator, whose name I'm forgetting off the top of my head, but it doesn't matter, Alan Anderson.
That's it.
I imagine your experience in healthcare really helped inform. I had a relative who was in the hospital recently, so I had gone through a lot of the experiences. Felt, man, you had those experiences nailed.
Well, thanks for saying that. I mean, I was an administrator for a lot of years, and I was the president of St. Joseph Hospital in Milwaukee for basically 5 years, and I finished my career. I thought maybe I was going to be retired, but I went back to work to get the Mental Health Emergency Center in Milwaukee off the ground. And we got that up and running and accredited. And that basically was opened and accredited by March of let's see, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now. And I retired right after that. It was kind of like time to devote myself full time to the writing. But when it comes to writing about injuries in hospitals, I mean, I've obviously been in hospitals yeah. most of my career. I know so many different physicians, including emergency physicians that I can reach out to and have leaned on. And then my oldest daughter, Kari, happens to be a surgeon. So I have her read the books, and there's certain things about, you know, she's actually a plastic and reconstructive surgeon. So when she has somebody, you know, like Michelle has her arm is sliced open. And so she helped me with that quite a bit to make sure that it was authentic. But I don't want to get bogged down either in any jargon or that kind of thing. So there's a little bit of a balance. I think sometimes you can know that stuff too well.
Yeah, I would guess that could be the case. But, you know, I mean, it's all very straightforward, your descriptions and so forth of what's going on and what medical, you know, there's a medical thing that happens to her that you describe pretty darn well, and even I could understand it. So it was well done. The characters, they visit many restaurants and coffee shops during the story. And you talk about, right, you mentioned already that many of them are real.
Yeah, I would say most of the coffee shops, restaurants, they are real. And, you know, I think it makes it more authentic. So, you know, and this started in the first book. In the first book, I had a scene where Michelle and Cole get together for the first time, and it's in an Italian restaurant. Now, I could just make one up, and I could describe, like, you know, the white and red checkered tablecloths and the wicker baskets with the candle, and it would be fake. But the Calderon Club in Milwaukee, I have been there 50 times. I mean, I could tell you what it smells like, what it sounds like, the ambiance. I could tell you what's on the menu. And so when I use that place, it's better. In this one, I have a place. So you probably know Milwaukee is arguably the most segregated city in the country. But there is a place there where St. Joseph Hospital sits. It's called Sherman Park. And Sherman Park is one of those kind of magical places where all these cultures and religions get together and live in pretty much harmony. And there's a place there. It's a coffee shop called the Sherman Perk, and it's run by Bob and Pat Olin. And Pat used to be a nurse at St. Joe's. But anyway, it used to be a filling station, and they made it into a coffee shop. And it's really kind of like one of those, the heartbeat of that neighborhood, because they have all these community events there. They have live music. They have different things that otherwise you're not going to find in that neighborhood that much. And I don't know. I love telling those stories. And I'll tell you one more. There's a place I had in my last book. It was called the La Finca Coffee Shop, and it's in St. Francis. It's within walking distance. The Milwaukee FBI field office is actually in St. Francis.
Okay.
It sits right on Lake Michigan, and it's amazing. But anyway, La Finca is owned by two sisters, and those sisters have a grandpa who lives in Mexico, and he has a coffee estate down there. So they buy their beans from him, they roast them, and they serve them to us in the Milwaukee area, and La Finca means the estate in Spanish. And so I get to tell these little stories, but I set scenes in these places. And it's funny, you know, I don't do product placement, so I've never taken money for it.
Yeah.
But my protagonist also loves a good craft beer, especially an IPA.
I figured you must like craft beer.
Yeah,
I like craft beer.
I do. Yeah. But I have never, you know, I would take a free beer from one of those breweries if it ever comes up. Just, I'm putting that out there, Larry.
Well, what do you, all right, La Finca or any of them, do you let them know in advance? Do you tell them, is it okay? Or what?
No.
You don't?
No. But it's funny because the only time I make up a name for a place like that is if something kind of bad is going down there. if I put it in a really positive light, sue me, you know, because I do. I have my MBA too, and I took business law and I took the law of mass communications, and they're going to have a hard time showing harm when I put them in a good light. And now that's me. My youngest son is a lawyer. He might disagree with that, but no, I don't. But it's funny because I've reached out to them afterward quite often and said, hey, okay. I just want to know. And so I ended up doing book signings at La Finca and at the Sherman Perk. I've done book signings at Good City Brewing and, you know, different places. And it's, you know, that's fun for me.
Yeah, it's kind of a marketing, I guess you could call it in a way.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll give you one other example of that. Have you ever heard of George Webb's? So George Webb is it's a restaurant. I'll call it a chain, but it's really, you know, 19 different diners all in the Milwaukee area. And it's a place that if you live in the Milwaukee area, you've either gone there after bar time or you've gone there after Sunday mass or something.
Or after a Brewers game.
Or after a Brewers game. If they win 13 in a row, you get a free burger. And so anyway, I actually have my protagonist, Cole, takes one of his people there after they get into an altercation at a bar. And it's just fun. And what was nice about that is I did reach out to George Webb, their marketing person, after the book came out. And I said, hey, just wanted to know I used you in this. And I gave him a copy of the book. And I said, if you like it, give me a shout out on your social media. And they have 25,000 followers. So, you know, well, how does that hurt me? Now, I'm sure, and they did it. I'm not saying all 25,000 George Webb readers are, you know, they're all avid readers, but it's been great for me.
I love that story. Well, in your book, and it's an interesting thing, when you're an FBI guy like Cole is, all right, here's his girlfriend, basically, who's been attacked, and it looks like there's a reason for the attack. So he's, you know, there's some protections and so forth that have to be made in her. But then, if you're in his position, there are all kinds of other things that are going on at the same time, and you can't just stop and focus all your attention on this one thing when you got all these other things that are going on. And these other things in your book were really interesting to me. You take on a lot of social issues in the book as part of the other things that Cole is working on. And you've got a poultry plant in Ladysmith that's using underage kids for dangerous jobs. And also coming into play is migrants who are illegal. So you've got right. that as an example.
Right. Well, and this is a
where'd that
a case...
come from, by the way?
What's that?
Where did that come from, by the way?
Well, first of all, let me say that the issue of using kind of these big societal issues, that's been the case from my first book.
Yeah.
And I will say, though, I hate it when I read a book by an author and they agendize. They try to tell me what to think about something. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that from people on the left, and I've seen it from people on the right, where they want to, you know, tell me what I should believe about this issue, and I don't like it. What I do want to do, again, first and foremost, I want to entertain.
Yeah.
But second of all, there are issues that we all ought to know about. So Big Pharma came up in this book a little bit. It came up a lot in the last book. You know, why are we paying three times as much in this country for our pharmaceuticals as other countries? Well, there's a long list. The biggest one is that industry is the biggest lobbyist when it comes to money dumped on Washington, D.C., and it's not even close. They're number one with a bullet. A lot of people think it's the defense industry, it's big oil. No, it's Big Pharma. And I once had a U.S. congressman. I was on his healthcare advisory committee, and I asked him after a meeting. At this time, we were only spending twice as much. But I said, why do we allow that? And he said, Kevin, if I'm ever asked, I'll deny I said this. But he said that's the one industry that has both sides of the aisle bought and paid for.
Wow.
And it just blew me away. And I think there are things that the public should know about. And some of them, I'm not even, you know, so I get into vigilantism a little bit. I get into journalistic integrity in one of my books. And in this one, I get into human trafficking, both in terms of for labor, but also for the sex trade. And when you think about, and I'll tell you, things that happen out in real life that I read about sometimes are so shocking that I can't let them go, and they're going to end up in a book. And one of those, I think it actually happened in Indiana. But there was a plant, a poultry plant, that was raided by the FBI and ICE, and they found, I think it was 20-some illegal immigrants working in this plant underage. And here's the thing. That industry, meatpacking, is one of, if not the most dangerous. Right. And which is why minors can't work there. And there was another situation. This was, I think, in Florida, where a kid who was 12 years old was working in a poultry plant like that and actually got caught in the machinery and was taken up to the ceiling and was asphyxiated, died. And it was horrific. And they looked at his ID, and it was of like a 35-year-old man. And this kid was 12. So these things really happened. I put them into fiction, but I use a quote in my second book, and it was by the French philosopher Albert Camus. And he says, fiction is the lie through which we tell the truth. And, I mean, you can get the truth out there through stories like these in a way that if the Wall Street Journal does a story in 6-point type, people might not wade through. But if you're reading a fast-paced thriller or some other novel, I think you might do it. The best example I can give of that is I think about what To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee did to challenge people about how they thought about race, right? And she didn't tell you what to think about race or how you should act, but she just told a story and caused us to think. And so in a very, very lesser way, I'm trying to do that. The other thing I get into in this book is congressional term limits, and I could talk about that for days.
I'd forgotten. I'd kind of forgotten about the congressional term limits, but it was. I'm glad you brought that part up as well. Well, how did you? Let's take the poultry. You must have done some research on poultry operations.
I did. And first of all, my dad grew up on a farm. I was at the farm a lot. So in terms of, they had both dairy, they had hog pens, they had chickens, and I've seen animals slaughtered, blah, blah, blah. I never went into a poultry plant, but I watched video after video of how these poultry plants work. And they're out there online where you can see them, and it's kind of crazy when you think about how many thousands of chickens go through these places in a day, these bigger places. And it is just kind of a maze of moving serpentine machinery that's
moving pretty fast,
constantly in motion. Yeah. And people are just, and, you know, there are lots and lots of safety and hygiene things that are in place. And I guess, you know, the industry today versus where it was even 10, 20 years ago is so much safer. The other thing I would say, too, is, you know, it's easy to point at these people in the poultry industry or meatpacking and say, how could you employ those kids? I do try to show, you know, like I use Ladysmith, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But imagine if you had a big plant outside of Ladysmith and they employed a lot of people, which was important to that city's livelihood. And all of a sudden, you don't have enough people, adult Americans that want to work there. And they place most of these plants in rural areas where the, you know, the chickens and hogs, whatever, are raised.
Where they're located.
And so, you know, I can see where well-intentioned people want to keep these plants open and do what has to be done. And then the other thing is, knowing the plight of some of these kids coming over to be in the USA, to have a job where they're actually making money and they're going to school is better than what they had. And I'm not forgiving anything. I'm just trying to say, I'm just like a reporter, like the reporters used to be back in the day before they started to just give their opinion. Some of this stuff, I don't even know how we solve it, but it's important people know what's going on.
Yeah, I think you are exactly right. Diane, who says she's one of your former high school classmates, emailed us. Diane said, just love all your books and the setting in Prairie du Chien. Diane says she gets a kick out of the names of your characters. It takes her back to her hometown. Keep on writing, and Diane looks forward to more of your books. So, well, that's nice. And names, it comes up. It just, do you use a lot of friends or former whatever?
Yes, I'm very guilty of that. And but what I do is I'm like Frankenstein, typically. I take like the first name of this person and the last name of that person. And I'm just like, when I do it, I'm chuckling to myself. And, you know, some of these are unsavory characters, right? And after that first book came out, I had different friends, and they say, how come my name's not in the book? And it's funny. There's a childhood friend. I knew her since kindergarten or even earlier. And she said that to me after the first book came out. And I'll just use her first name. It's Nancy. But anyway, in the second book, my villain is a villainess. She's a horrific woman. and I might have used her name for that character. And then when that book came out, I had to reach out to her before it came out. And I said, Nancy, just so you know, your name, I did get it in there this time. I hope you're okay with it. And she has a good sense of humor, so she was fine with it. But there was one time, too, where I used the full name of somebody. And it happened by accident. I had a lawyer, and his name was Frank Barrister. That's what I was going to use. And when my editors went through it, they said, do you know what a barrister is? And I said, yeah, it's a lawyer. It's kind of an English word. And they're like, well, that's too clever by half or whatever that saying is. And so they said, what do you want to use? And so I said, well, how about Frank Gamina? And Frank may be out there. but anyway, so the name Frank Gamina is in that. And when the book was coming out, his wife, Susie, on Facebook, she put a note on one of the things, and she said, I can't wait to read it. This is great. And I said, Susie, just, you know, Frank's name might be in the book, or you might recognize a name. And then I reached out to Frank via text, and I said, Frank, I used your name as a character in my book, and it's Frank Gamina. He's a lawyer. And Frank said, well, I don't care, as long as, you know, he's a good guy, right? And I said, well, as good as a lawyer can be. So I have had a blast. I have had a blast with it, Larry. But you can't imagine how many names you need to come up with if you're writing several books.
I've got a list of Clara gave me a list of all the names just so I'd have them in front of me. The main characters. And there's like a dozen.
Yeah.
And not counting all of the other ones that come into play.
Right.
In the book. And the book is The Killer's Terms, and the author is Kevin Kleisner. He's our guest today until noon. It's great to have him with us. And a question about the book itself or about writing, perhaps, maybe even marketing. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. The Larry Mueller Show book club book for this time is The Killer's Terms. The author, Kevin Kleisner, with me in the studio. It's great to be talking with him about his book, his books, really, and about his writing. And I hope you'll join in. Questions 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Tell us about the research you did on how the FBI operates and the workflow of cases and that sort of thing.
So when I first started this, I didn't know anything about it. But I would say I read voraciously. Stephen King used to say, if you want to be a writer, you should read a lot and write a lot. And I think that's as simple as it gets. But I read probably at least a book a week, and I would say 90% of that is fiction, and 90% of that are thrillers. So in terms of understanding the genre, that type of thing, I think I had kind of a good grounding. But in terms of, like, how federal agents work, that kind of thing, I didn't know a whole lot. And so I actually found a guy. His name was Al Cibini, and Al was a retired federal agent, recently retired. And I said, Al, would you read this manuscript? So before I ever shopped it out, I had him read it. And it's funny because he didn't find the kind of things I thought he might. The kind of things that he pointed out to me were that I'm very loyal, and so my character is very loyal, Cole. And I had him loyal to an Acura TSX, which is what I drive. And Al said, yeah, well, I know you don't want to use, because I didn't want to use the black SUV like everybody uses. And so he says, but it's going to be a domestic car. And he said, you could use a Dodge Charger. So that's what I did. I used a Dodge Charger. He gave me other hints like that. And then if you're a published author, or if you're, you know, have the, you're greenlit to do a movie or something, the FBI actually has a whole department set up to help us.
Oh, so, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so now with the second and the third book, when I've had questions, I've just reached out to them. And these are actual FBI agents who kind of get rotated out of the field and they have to work. I don't know if they love it or hate it, but so I've had these guys and gals available to help me with different questions. And then there are times, like in my second book, I had a scene that took place right on the Mississippi River between Wisconsin and Iowa. I had to reach out to the Iowa DNR to ask some questions about what kind of boat would they use, you know, what would they for search and rescue, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, I don't research that kind of thing to death. I'm never going to let something that might be a trivial procedural thing get in the way of a good story. But I do want to be as true to it as I can be.
And you often use statistics or in a very simple, it's pretty straightforward way when you're talking about these issues, which I appreciated. And I thought, I think those numbers are pretty accurate.
Yes, those are. I mean, even when I get into these issues about human trafficking and term limits, when I talk about the Pew Research Center, their latest research says that 87% of the adults in the U.S. want term limits, but they haven't brought it up for a vote in over 30 years now. That's all true.
Yeah. There's a reason that it hasn't been brought up.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you get into another one of the issues that Cole works on is one involving a missing Native American woman. And that's another issue that is maybe in existence here in Wisconsin. Probably is.
It is.
It is.
And as a matter of fact, it's bad enough. You know, I say that there's a special commission that was set up, a task force to look into that, and that's actually true. So it's an issue, the human trafficking issue, and young people kind of disappearing that's a real issue in the state, and it's even in rural areas, and it's an even bigger issue with female Native Americans. And so, like I said, there is a commission in the state that's looking at how to why is this happening? What do we do about it?
And there's another, in the sex trafficking side of things, there's another incident that involves several restaurant, bars, whatever, across the country. And I wondered to myself if something like that actually existed.
That was the evil in my mind that came up with that.
Boy, it was chilling to think of that. As a possibility. Cole's a very tough, capable, charismatic person. How do you write such a lovable main character but still make him human?
It's funny because I'm sure there are a few people out there that, again, have known me for a long time that are listening. And when I've given an author talk, I grew up in Prairie du Chien. And when I do my author talk there, this last time we had, I think it was 60 people. We had some people out in the hallway, and it was just great. I mean, they've been so supportive.
Yeah.
But what was, help me out with the question again.
Well, how do you, he's a lovable character, but he's still a human.
So, you know, I take the best traits of myself. So the guy he was born in Prairie du Chien, 2 degrees from Marquette. He wrestled. He lives in Milwaukee now. All those things are true of me. And I've had people say, well, he's you, isn't he? And I say, well, yes, if I was just a little taller, smarter, you know, stronger, he would be me. But I try to, you know, I don't want any character to be cookie cutter or some cardboard cutout. I want them to have weaknesses. I want them to have weak moments. I want them to feel the downs as much as they feel the ups. And, you know, I don't like somebody who's superhuman. That's not what this series is meant to be.
No. I certainly agree with that. Oh, Cassandra emailed us just as a comment on using friends' names. Cassandra says, Nelson DeMille uses friends' names in his books if his friends will make a donation to charity.
And when I'm as famous as Nelson DeMille, or you mentioned John Grisham before, I'll do that same thing.
Oh, man. So you've got three, this is the third, and now you've got a chance to write another one. Your publisher wants you to go ahead. Is that what you're going to do? Or
actually, no. I am going to continue the series because the characters have become like family to me. But I did tell my publisher I want to continue the series, but I need to take a bit of a sabbatical because I have an idea for an historical fiction novel set in the early 1830s in Prairie du Chien. And I'm going to have to find a different publisher because that's out of their kind of their genre they deal with. But there were so many things that took place then. We had Jefferson Davis was there, who ends up being the head of the Confederacy. You had Chief Black Hawk. You had Zachary Taylor, who ends up being the 12th president. You have William Beaumont, who ends up being the father of gastroenterology. And he did that by keeping a soldier who had an open stomach wound. He could have closed the wound, but he kept it open so he could see what happened when something would be digested and what it would look like. And you also had five African-American women who were in Prairie du Chien at the time, which is probably five more than are there today. But two were indentured servants, two were slaves, and one was free. One of those free women ends up being the first doctor in Wisconsin. And so wow. I call it the confluence. I haven't written three words, but it's the confluence of where the Mississippi and Wisconsin rivers come together, and it's the confluence of all these important people at a certain point in time.
Well, let me know when you get that book finished, because we'll get you back for that for sure.
Oh, bless you.
In the meantime, The Killer's Terms are really a great read, and Kevin, I thank you so much for writing it and for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Kevin Kleisner, the author and the book, The Killer's Terms. It was great to have him with us and for our book club. And I'm hoping that we'll get him back when his next book comes out. That's that, and Buried the Sheen. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about EarthFest and EarthFest activities. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking now about an event called EarthFest. It's a week-long event, and it celebrates environmental and sustainability research that's going on at the UW-Madison campus, and we have a couple of guests for you. One, Chelsea Rademacher, is communications manager of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. And Chelsea, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry.
Great to have you here, and I'm great to have Lauren Graves with us as well, who's the communications manager for the Office of Sustainability and at UW. Lauren, great to have you with us, too. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Larry.
And the two of them put their heads together and organized this fest.
Well, we can't take full credit, and we certainly won't take most credit. We are just the kind of chaotic marketing masterminds behind getting the word out there, I would say. This event has been almost decades in the making, I would say. Last year was the inaugural year of EarthFest, and it was the uniting of two events that had formerly happened on campus and off campus. Part was hosted by the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, and it was our annual Earth Day conference. This started back in, I think, 2008, around there. It was a day-long event at the Monona Terrace, and speakers would come in like Neil deGrasse Tyson and Jane Goodall, and we would really engage with our alumni network in the community. So that was one way that the Nelson Institute and environmental and sustainability work at the university engaged with folks around Earth Day. But then the Office of Sustainability had a separate initiative called Earth Week. And I'll let Lauren speak to that a little bit. And then we can talk about how we came together for this Earth Festival.
Yeah, go ahead, Lauren.
Yeah, so like Chelsea mentioned, we've had a lot of different events popping up on campus. And as you can imagine, every spring, it's not just the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies or the Office of Sustainability that are hosting environmental events. And Chelsea mentioned one big one that the Nelson Institute has hosted for a long time. And in 2018, the Office of Sustainability's student interns, our undergraduates, came together and tried to create a counterpart to the Nelson Institute's public-facing offering that historically used to be at the Monona Terrace. I remember that was one of the first times I ever worked in a professional capacity in the environment, actually. Was tabling at an Earth Day conference.
No way.
Yeah, maybe like 2016 or 17.
It was meant to be, Lauren.
It was meant to be. We've come full circle. But so our undergrads in the Office of Sustainability, and of course this predates when I was in the office, but in 2018 they came together and they tried to create something where by students, for students, a week of events that would pull people together and celebrate the work that happens on campus. And over time, we work closely together for a lot of different things, but eventually we came together and started building a team to not just pull together the Earth Day and Earth Week events on campus, but also to try and unify all events that are happening on campus and really put a spotlight on the work that's happening at Madison.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And the fact that Earth Day is really a Wisconsin invention, I guess we could say, makes it even more special and more important and great that you guys are doing this.
Absolutely. It's really important for us to show this work that's happening on campus and how it extends to Wisconsin and the world. And like you said, bringing it back. Earth Day is rooted here in Wisconsin. Senator Gaylord Nelson, Earth Day was his idea.
Yeah.
It was around 1969, he heard about teach-ins that were happening in California about the Vietnam War and activism around that. And he wondered, what if all colleges did this, but for the environment? And then April 22nd of 1970, we had the first Earth Day, and the rest is history. And of course, Gaylord Nelson is the namesake for the Nelson Institute. So those roots run really deep, and we're excited to find a really modern and innovative way to celebrate that legacy and that history here.
Yeah, we're really thrilled to bring Earth Day home, back home yeah. again. And, you know, from Wisconsin to the world, like Chelsea mentioned, Earth Day has its roots here. But even beyond Gaylord Nelson, we have a really deep environmental history, as many Madisonians and Dane County folks will know. It's, you know, we have Aldo Leopold and many others at our institution and from this land that have, you know, 175 years of institutional momentum in this space. And EarthFest is a new modern way to kind of bring that and share it out with the state.
I think it's one of the interesting parts of this is that you bring together science, music, poetry. I've interviewed Bassam Shakashiri of chemistry many times on this program, and that's something that he was big on doing. How are all these disciplines related to celebrating the event? Chelsea, you wanna...
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way to frame it with Professor Shakashiri. And we actually recently had one of our faculty members receive the Shakashiri Public Science Engagement Award. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the vein that we're trying to always keep. Science is fun, as Shakashiri yeah. says, and bringing it home that way. I think the interdisciplinary nature of environmental studies and sustainability work can really be seen throughout these events, because when you're studying the environment, or if you care about the environment, that doesn't happen in a vacuum. There are many ways that you can relate that work out into the world. So you mentioned music. I'll talk a little bit about one of those events coming up. This is on the 21st. It's called Earth Signals. And so a researcher named Liz Maroon, who is a climate scientist. Mm-hmm. She teamed up with an undergraduate student, and they took forecasts from El Nino. So how you can take forecasts of the weather. Is it going to rain this weekend? When's the snow coming? We can tell what El Nino is possibly going to do based on forecasting. So they took a series of forecasts, and they went through a process called sonification, which typically takes data points and pairs them with frequencies. They changed it a little bit and paired it to musical notes, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Then they teamed up with a PhD candidate named Ben Ferris in the School of Music, who took those notes, set it to the scale B Lydian for any of my fellow music fans out there, and he created an original composition based on these notes pulled from these El Nino forecasts. So this composition is going to be debuted live April 21st, that's Monday, so come on down to the Hamel Music Center and hear it. But that for me is one that it's like, you can see how this just transcends disciplines. This is work that crosses everything.
And we should nail it all down here as to the dates and locations. You mentioned the Hamel, Lauren, go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Larry. So EarthFest is happening April 21st through 29th all across campus, every corner of campus, whether it's the Lakeshore Nature Preserve or Allen Centennial Garden, or even facilities planning and management on one of the patios showing what kind of stormwater simulations, how we're managing our campus to improve the environment right here in Madison. So it's really happening all over, like Chelsea mentioned, very interdisciplinary. We have 65 plus events and just as many, if not more, partners from every school, college, unit, and division on campus, and some community partners as well.
To pull it all together, you've got to go to a website, I'm guessing.
You sure do. And you can see it all at earthfest.wisc.edu, earthfest.wisc.edu. We have our full schedule of events there and some other bonus features like the official EarthFest playlist and some fun things you can check out there.
Well, okay, so I definitely wanted to get that in because I knew that events are happening in a lot of different locations, and it may not be physically possible to get to all of them. Let's go back to, so Monday is the first day of the festival.
Yes.
One event is called Plants for the Apocalypse.
Oh, we love this one.
Wow. What will you learn about the relationship between humans and plants at this event? Talk about that.
Well, I believe it varies year to year. We are this year featuring Plants for the Apocalypse 3. And last year, actually, Chelsea and I had the chance to attend. This is a repeat. Last year was the inaugural Earth Fest. We should say that, too. This is our second time hosting. And this is an event where you have different folks throughout Ellen Centennial Garden and I believe Kells, is it Kells, Chelsea?
School of Pharmacy.
School of Pharmacy. See, there's so many partners, it's easy to cross our wires. But so School of Pharmacy and others on campus are coming together and sharing us unexpected things about plants that they really like and almost, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's kind of you jump in and it's kind of what plants would you want if it was kind of the end of the world or what are the different uses for these plants? And my fun fact from last year, the whole EarthFest team went together. It was the last event of the year, and told us how good potatoes are and the nutritional value of potatoes and a really fun narrative for such a common vegetable that you wouldn't expect.
Sure.
And big fan of that event.
Yeah. We think about potatoes regularly now, I would say.
Okay. Well, there's an eco-poetry workshop, and I'm going to read you a poem, and you're going to have to tell me if this is an eco-poetry poem or not. Jill Nadeau, who is well known for her poetry writing and is our producer, has whipped one up for me. It says, wind whips through the trees, a chill on sun-warmed skin, spring's wild, playful dance. Now, I kind of liked it myself. Would you call that what's the definition of eco-poetry?
I think the beautiful thing about poetry in general is it can be anything you want it to be. and to really learn about eco-poetry and what that means, well, we'd love to see you at our event. Of course, you know, this is a great question. I'm being silly. But do come. so I think in terms of eco-poetry, we're just thinking about what is our human connection to the earth. And for you, that may mean something different than it means for me. It may mean something that means for Lauren. So I think that's absolutely an example of eco-poetry. And the great thing about this event is it's being led by Heather Swan, who's a faculty member in the English department and the Nelson Institute. And in the event description, it says anyone can be a poet. You don't need experience. You just need a pencil and paper.
Well, Jill just shot me a note and said, "Make sure you say that I drew it with I did it with AI."
We appreciate the disclaimer,
the
Jill.
The word is out on you, Jill. Thanks a lot for that description. Tuesday, there's a presentation about UW's climate research. There's been a lot of research that's happened at the UW over many decades relating to the climate. So what are some of the research projects that are happening that will be talked about?
Yeah, this one is hosted by the Nelson Institute's Center for Climatic Research, and they're going to be focusing in on four different research projects that are happening on campus. One is about how we can use solar energy for both food and electricity. So this goes into a project called Agrivoltaics, which Lauren knows much more about than I do. It's really interesting. Lauren, do you want to preview a little of what agrivoltaics is?
Yeah, so agrivoltaics is a compound word, agriculture and photovoltaics. So essentially we're looking for co-benefits and dual use of producing both energy through solar panels and also crops or grazing on the same piece of land. So really taking a look at how Wisconsin farmers, communities, institutions can reap co-benefits that are both good for the soil and the crops you're growing, but also really good for our energy sources.
That's a good one. What are there others?
Yeah, there's a handful of others in this. This is an hour-long event from 1 to 2 p.m. on Tuesday, Earth Day. You'll also be able to hear from Bridget Mason, who is the assistant state climatologist in our Wisconsin State Climatology Office, and they do some really impressive and fantastic work. So they're going to do an overview of who they are, what they do. If you've ever wondered when the ice on Lake Mendota has frozen, in the history of record keeping. They know it. So that'll be great to hear from. And then another one I'll point to is the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, which is a collaborative project with the Wisconsin DNR on how we can ready our state for climate change and adapt. They'll be giving another overview of some of the solutions that they've come up with collaboratively, excuse me, with communities.
There's also a chance on, I forget the day. Is it Tuesday where you have the volunteer opportunity to help clean up a nature preserve?
Yes, we have a couple of volunteer opportunities. Chelsea, do you have that one up?
I do, yeah. Volunteering at the Lakeshore Nature Preserve, that's another Earth Day, Tuesday the 22nd. That's from 3 to 5 p.m. And this is being hosted by students from the Mortgage Center for Public Service and the Actuarial Science Club at UW-Madison. Anyone is welcome to attend, do a cleanup in the native plant garden, collect litter. And the Lakeshore Nature Preserve is a particularly great place.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place.
It is. And Lauren can give a quick preview of some more exciting things that are happening there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, I should, and for those who might not be familiar, the Lakeshore Nature Preserve is an incredible 300-acre space that spans the coast on the lake here in Madison, and we're really grateful to have it. It's a great place for being a living lab for a lot of the research and education that's happening in the classrooms. Folks can go out to Picnic Point and Frouchy Point and the Great Marsh out there and do a lot of hands-on research, which is wonderful. And it's a three-man team managing all 300 acres. They're part of our Office of Sustainability as well. And they're hosting a variety of events from late night birding. I'm really looking forward to that one. Larry, if you have any birding fans in your audience, we've got some great experts joining us at 6 o'clock on, I forget which evening, but if you go to earthfest.wisc.edu, you'll be able to find it along with many other great events. And, you know, we're coming up on peak birding migration. And so they're just a really great place for rich ecological history and place-based learning. It's really where research meets reality here on campus.
I went on a birding expedition out there a few years back, and it was a lot of fun, and there were a lot of birds.
Yeah.
No question about that. And this is the really the kind of the perfect time. The trees aren't all leafed out. The birds are singing because it's time to make more birds, so to speak. And so there's a lot of activity going on at that preserve. So a fun thing to do. And again, it's Tuesday, right?
Bird hike. The Lakeshore Nature Preserve cleanup is Tuesday. The bird hike is April 27th.
Okay. All right. There's also a medication take back event. And that was kind of an interesting one to me. What's going to happen? People are going to be able to bring...
Yeah. So this is hosted through University Health Services. So they run all of the... health, flu shots, counseling services for students here at the UW-Madison campus. And if you think just about your own medicine cabinet, I mean, I've probably got a bottle of Tylenol in there from 2005 that needs to be disposed of. You may think, oh, I'll throw it, I'll flush it. There are better ways to dispose of your medications, whether they're prescription, vitamins, cold medicine, that are more environmentally conscious. So University Health Services is going to be offering two medication take-back events during EarthFest where you can bring any unwanted, opened, expired medications of any type, no questions asked, and they will take them and dispose of them in an environmentally friendly way.
I wonder how they do it.
You know what? I do, too.
I don't know. I don't know how they do it. It'd be interesting to know how they do it. Well, maybe they'll be able to tell you when.
I bet they would, yeah. When I bring my 2005 Tylenol, I'll ask them.
I think it'd be worth asking for sure. Thursday, there's a plant-based dye workshop, and students are going to be demonstrating some of their skills at that, I believe.
Yeah, this one was an event that was held last year, and it saw a really great turnout. So we're glad that they came back. This is hosted with the School for Human Ecology and their Design and Textiles department. So these students, through one of their classes, are learning how to make clothing dyes out of think of any natural materials, leaves, flowers, acorns, and they're going to be demonstrating some of their work. There's some beautiful photos that you can see on our website from last year of just these tapestries hanging throughout the D.C. Smith greenhouses with these various dyes. And they'll also be leading a hands-on workshop using indigo as a dye, which is pretty common. You know, many of us have indigo in our landscaping or in the fields near our homes. So they're going to show you how you can turn those seed pods and those plants into dyes to make your own clothing.
And Friday, we've got the sustainability of global food production. And I believe there are many, many events that we haven't covered yet. Any events that you'd like to highlight, maybe that'll happen over the weekend in our last minute or so?
Well, it's not happening over the weekend, but one I'm particularly excited for will be the Planet Walker film screening, and Chelsea is actually going to be the best person to speak on this, but we're really, really looking forward to this event.
Title again?
The title of the film is Planet Walker. It's a short documentary, and it's about John Francis. And if you don't know who John Francis is, you definitely want to, because his story is incredible. He's a UW-Madison graduate. He earned his PhD here in the Nelson Institute in 1991 while completely silent. He earned his PhD during a vow of silence, where he also vowed off motor vehicles. And he did this after witnessing an oil spill in 1971 in California. At that moment, he swore off any motorized transit, planes, cars, and took a vow of silence. And he walked his way across the country, completing his studies. He is an incredible person. And he's going to be with us live on Earth Day at this screening.
But not silent.
But not silent anymore, although I am told he meditates daily, which sometimes can last the whole day.
Wow. Well, I don't think I'd have the patience to meditate all day long. I sometimes have a hard time doing it for 1 minute.
I'm told 1 minute's all it takes, though, to, you know, start that practice. But I'm with you, Larry.
And you know, Larry, there's an Earth Fest event for that, too. We've got mindfulness, meditation, and yoga events throughout the week as well. So
there are a lot of events we haven't even talked about. I tell you what, how do people find out, again, about the array of events taking place?
Absolutely. We encourage everyone to go to earthfest.wisc.edu, and there you'll be able to learn both about our partners, but also about all 65-plus events and many ways to get involved, whether you're on campus or if you're not on campus. There are ways to watch some of these films, zoom in to some of the online and virtual hybrid events. So take a look there. And also follow us on Instagram if you use Instagram. We'll be doing a lot of live daily updates and behind-the-scenes looks. So even if you're not able to participate, you can get a look into the window of what sustainability education research really looks like in Madison.
It's very, very cool. Well, I thank you both very much for coming by. We'll have to do it again maybe in another year.
Hey.
Who knows?
It's a date.
Thank you.
Lauren Graves is Communication Manager for the Office of Sustainability at UW-Madison. Chelsea Rademacher is a Communications Manager at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. It's great to have them with us. And go to that site and take a look. You know, 60-some events, and you're going to find one or more, probably many more, that you're going to want to take part in. And it's free. Most of it's free. No expense involved. Coming up, we're going to take a look at shoes and shoe repair with our next guest, Dave Franks. I'm Larry Mealer. Great to have you along here for WPR News. Larry Mealer here, and we're going to turn our attention to shoes and shoe repair. You know, producer Clara Neipert always says that wearing shoes that are comfortable and well-fitting help you put your best foot forward. On that note, Dave Franks probably has heard that, maybe, and probably believes that. Well, he's with us for the rest of the show. He's the owner of Lakeland Shoe Repair in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Dave's been in the shoe repair industry for more than 50 years, And man, he does some fascinating and amazing work with shoes. He'll tell us all about it as we move along today. And maybe I hope you'll join in with your own questions. You got a favorite pair of shoes? I've had some favorite shoes that I've actually had taken to a shoe repair shop here in Madison and had fixed, and I love it. Let us know how you keep the footwear you buy in good condition. Maybe you've got a question about keeping them in good condition. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dave Franks, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Larry. I appreciate you, and I look forward to this next half hour where I get to talk about my industry for a little bit.
Tell us about that industry. I mean, you have gone over and above, I think, in terms of your own training. I was impressed with the work you've done. But talk about the business.
Well, it's a business that's been around forever. It's probably one of the oldest businesses or professions in history. I started working for my grandpa in 71, and during that time, I think we could honestly say that the shoe repair industry was in decline even back then. It was the advent of plastic shoes and foreign-made shoes started making shoe repair less viable for people. And as it so happens, in 1971, I believe there were over 60,000 shoe repair shops in the country. And since after COVID now, I think there's around 3,000 left. So it's a big change over the years. But I'll tell you what, the ones that are left are very, very busy.
Yeah, I bet. Why should somebody consider getting their shoes repaired instead of just going out and buying a new pair? What are the benefits?
Well, there's many benefits. Just a couple off the top of my head. You're going to save time. I mean, the average person will spend a couple hours going out shopping for a new pair of shoes, and you're going to be in and out of my shop in 5 minutes. You save money. Most shoe repair jobs are going to be a fraction of the cost of a new pair. People who buy quality footwear are going to spend a little bit more, but their shoes are going to last a lot longer. Here, I'll give you an example, Larry. I had a fellow come in not too long ago with a pair of Red Wing boots. He said he'd had them for 11 years, and he wanted me to resole them. Well, I charged right around $100 to resole those boots. He said to replace them would have cost him about $325. Then he told me his son mocked him for having his boots repaired. And he said, son, I've had these boots for 11 years. I'm going to put $100 into them. They're probably going to last me another 11 years. And yet you, on the other hand, you spend $50, $60 on a pair of boots and you replace them every 6 months. So who's ahead in the end? You know, the old saying is you get what you pay for. And I think that can be most true or mainly true with your footwear.
Yeah, I would agree. What types of shoes are you able to repair? It's not just leather. You can also replace perhaps a cloth tennis shoe?
Absolutely. You know, we do repairs on just about anything. You know, I've over the years I've just hated any time I had to turn down a job. So I'd sit and try and figure stuff out, figure out how I can do it, what glues might work better, or threads, or whatever materials. And we can fix just about anything nowadays. Oftentimes, it doesn't pay. You know, if you've got a pair of $20 shoes, it doesn't pay to resole or reheal them because, you know, the cost would be more than a new pair. That's where the you get what you pay for comes in, Larry. So you buy a good quality shoe, you buy an Allen Edmonds dress shoe, a Florsheim Imperial. You buy a good pair of Danner boots or Red Wings or Thoroughgoods, they're going to last. I've got guys that have been bringing me their Allen Edmonds dress shoes for 30 years, the same pair.
Wow.
And it's amazing. But, you know, you buy something cheap, it just doesn't pay to repair them sometimes. You know, a lot of our work nowadays is the glue on the sole comes loose. They need to be re-glued or a boot hook comes out. You know, there's a lot of minor repairs that go on. But the meat of our business is heels and soles, and now we do a lot of orthopedic type work. I used to be a certified podorthist, so I studied making orthotics and doing shoe modifications. That's become a big part of our business today now.
I was wondering about other parts of the business too. My own visits to a shoe repair shop didn't have anything to do with shoes at all.
Right.
I for example, my dad once bought me a baseball glove that I had really wanted, and he probably shouldn't have spent the money that he spent, to be perfectly honest. It was an expensive thing, expensive glove.
Right.
And I was a teenager, and I was really happy to get the glove, and then afterwards I felt a little I felt bad about kind of, you know, the fact that my dad spent all that money. Well, anyway, the glove, the lacings.
Sure.
Went.
Yep. That's a common thing. We do a lot of relacing of baseball gloves. And you're right, they're not cheap. You know, as a matter of fact, I used to turn it away. I used to turn that job away because I didn't think it was worthwhile to the customer for me to put that much work and time and money into it. But one day I was walking through department store, and I happened to see a rack of baseball gloves, and I looked at the price, and I was shocked at how expensive they were. So I started repairing baseball gloves right away, and now that's it's not a big part of the business, but it's something that we enjoy to do and are happy to do.
Well, it's certainly, I still have that glove.
Yeah, you know, you buy a good glove and you keep it oiled, it's going to last forever.
Oh, man. So the what is your day-to-day job like?
Well, I was in the shop this morning. I got up early, and my shop's attached to my home, so that makes it real easy for me. I can go into work, and although we have regular hours that we're open, I can go to work anytime I want. And you know, at my age, I'm kind of winding down and more trying to work part time rather than full time. But so I went in the shop this morning, and I worked on three or four pairs of boots and shoes that needed full soles. I probably had a dozen pair of men's and women's shoes that needed heels. I had a couple of orthopedic jobs. I did a boot hook, replaced a boot hook on something. And the job, it's the thing I think I like the most about my job is I'm not doing the exact same thing every day. You know, I've always got something different on my bench.
What are the maybe describe the tools and techniques you use to make the shoe repairs that you make?
Well, we use hammers and we call heel lifters. We use I guess I can't think of the name. They're kind of like a pliers, but like with a flat. You know, it's something that we can grab onto a heel, grab and tear a heel off. So we've got a lot of cutters. We use a lot of different knives and punches and awls and needles, things like that. If you came in and looked at my bench, it's backed with pegboard that's got just about every slot filled. And there's probably at least 200 tools up on that pegboard. And most of them, you wouldn't recognize.
I might recognize some of them. I took a leathercraft class in 4-H back when I was a kid, and I made a pair of moccasins, and I made a nice belt. I still have the belt. Although it does no longer fit around me. I keep it.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's funny how them belts shrink after a few years, huh?
Oh, man. Stephen Economowoc has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Okay. Yeah, hi, guys. Thanks for this great show. My wife bought me a pretty good quality Wilson leather coat about 30 years ago. And it's well-worn, it's well-faded, and I get a lot of comments all the time on how cool that jacket looks. But I have some repair spots on the cuffs and the sleeve and a couple other spots, just small repairs. How would I get that fixed?
Are they like tears or just spots that are worn off, or are you just talking they're discolored?
Just worn through.
They're worn through.
Okay. Well, cuffs can usually be repaired pretty easily just by adding some leather to make a new cuff. Sleeves, if it's usually it's on the elbows, elbow patches can be put on pretty reasonably. Find yourself a shoe repairer down there, in your area, and you probably find somebody that can do a job like that.
Do you is your work all local, Dave? Do people come from a distance sometimes to have you do work?
Yeah, we get work, Larry, from all over the place. As a matter of fact, we take in a lot through the mail too. My original shops were in Racine, and we decided we had a place up here in Rhinelander that we come and vacation at. We decided we want to live here. And we had our home had a built-on workshop, so we just moved everything into that workshop. And then we ran both shops for a while. So we had one in Racine, one in Rhinelander up here, and then we would ship work back and forth. But now it turns out that over the years we've had many customers that enjoy our work and have a hard time finding somebody. There will be people that have moved away. Mostly, and they send stuff to us. We get stuff from all over the country. As a matter of fact, a month ago, we sent shoes to Bucharest, Hungary.
Oh, my goodness.
So the fellow that was a regular customer of ours who works for the State Department, and now he's stationed in Bucharest, and he ships his shoes back and forth. And we've shipped shoes back and forth to Spain, from England, and absolutely all over the United States we get work from. We shipped a pair out a couple of weeks ago to the Florida Keys, to Key West. And they're coming from all over the place.
That is really cool and a testament to the quality of the work you do as well. I'm sure of that. I know you even reheal, like, Birkenstock sandals. These are expensive to buy.
Yeah. And most people think you wear the heels out or the soles out on your Birks. You got to just go buy a new pair. Well, we resole and reheel Birkenstocks. Almost every week we've got a couple of pairs in the shop. And even when the cork gets bad, we've got cork that we can use to replace the worn spots. And you'd be surprised how nice them Birkenstocks turn out when we're done with them. And usually it's for half the price of a new pair.
Oh, man. Dave Frank, our guest today, he is the owner of Lakeland Shoe Repair in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, talking shoes and shoe repair with him. And actually, as we're sort of indicating here, he repairs and resolves things other than shoes as well and boots. And we'll talk some more about that, too. You can join in with your own question or comment. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Dave Franks, owner of Lakeland Shoe Repair in Rhinelander. And again, you can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. A listener from West Salem emailed us, Dan's in La Crosse made an adjustment to some favorite leather shoes of theirs, and they can wear the shoes comfortably now in spite of a bunion, thanks to him and all the helpful shoe craftsmen and women. And That's a nice comment from our West Salem listener. And you can make those kind of adjustments as well.
Absolutely. You know, we stretch shoes. I've got every kind of shoe stretcher you can imagine. So we can spot stretch a shoe. We can concentrate on a certain area or just do general stretching. I've got boots in now, brand-new women's boots that she brought three pair. We're stretching the calves, we're stretching the toes, and we're stretching the vamps on all three pairs. So, you know, it's probably the most common job that we do, shoe stretching. People go in and buy a pair of shoes, and they feel good in the shoe store. And you get home, you wear them for an hour or two, and you realize, oh, these feel a little tight. So they bring them to us, and we can fix that up.
Yeah. I think you're better off to buy shoes later in the day when your feet are bigger.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Larry. You know, we buy a pair of shoes that's one size, and we're trying to fit a pair of feet that might be three or four different sizes throughout the day.
Lisa in Kakana has something. Let's go there. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple pairs of OnCloud tennis shoes that are not outright, well, they're, for me, it's $125, $150 to pay for. And within about 6 months, and I don't wear them every day, I get little holes like in the mesh. And just one hole, one was on the side, one was at the top of my foot, and another one right in the seam. And I wear wide shoes, so it's not, I mean, they're fitted for me. Does it pay to bring them in, and can you fix the mesh, or is it written off?
Well, you know, I'm afraid something like that, although it can be repaired, and we can patch something like that, but it probably wouldn't look the best. You know, I'm going to be honest with you. Sometimes when you're dealing with fabric, you can't do an exact match. So the patching would probably be visible, although it would be functional. It wouldn't be something I'd be proud to do, you know what I'm saying?
Okay. Lisa, there you go. Laura in Eagle River, it's your turn. Hi, Laura.
Hi, good morning or good afternoon. I'm really excited to hear this program today. I live in Eagle River, which is obviously close to Rhinelander, and thrilled to hear that we have a shoe repair close by again. I grew up in Cambridge, and my father was a cobbler at a shoe store in Cambridge for over 30 years, and then he ran a shoe repair shop in Fort Atkinson and Stoughton. And so thrilled to hear you're nearby, because my husband oftentimes needs shoes repaired, and we drive them all the way down to southern Wisconsin.
Glad
to hear there's something. Yes, yes, and I may come along just to enjoy the smells. There's nothing for me that's better than that smell of a shoe repair shop. It just brings back floods of memories.
When we had our shop in Racine, it was in a busy shopping district. And oftentimes somebody would be walking by to go get a cup of coffee, and they would just come in, open the door, and stick their head in and just say, I just wanted to get a smell. There's something about it. I don't know what it is, but people really enjoy the smell of leather, I guess. I guess that's what it is.
Yeah. Laura, thanks a lot for calling. It's no longer the fellow retired, but there was a shop on South Park Street in Madison, that you'd go to that shop and it smelled great in there. But there'd always be, I don't think I ever went in there, there wasn't at least one local guy just sitting there talking while the cobbler worked.
Yeah.
Usually two or three.
Yeah, it's kind of like the barber shop, the old barber shops where fellas would sit around and shoot the breeze, right?
Mary in Appleton has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hello. It's not exactly a repair question, but I'm wondering the best way to clean white leather sneakers.
So have you got on them?
Yeah.
It's just kind of the normal, you know, wear and tear dirt.
Yeah.
Are they leather?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then you want to find some type of a leather cleaning product. You could use saddle soap or something a little stronger, or you could try just a diluted Dawn dish soap. Just dilute Dawn with some water and with a soft nylon brush. That is, I'm going to tell you, this is a secret for shoe repairers, but Dawn dish soap has been a big help to our trade. It does wonders on so many things. So I would give that a try. You know, some of the shoes nowadays are machine washable, and they would instruct you to take your insoles out and then your laces out and just run them through a gentle cycle on your washing machine. Now, I don't know if your pair, there should be a label on there somewhere that would say that, but that's an option too.
All right, man. I like the Dawn idea. Dawn works on a lot of things.
Yeah, it sure does.
Dennis emailed us. He says, how do you manage your old footwear? You cobble things together.
Yeah, okay.
You probably heard that one before, Dave.
In 50 years, I've heard them all many, many times.
What's your some of your oddest requests?
Well, you know, I'm just sitting here this morning. I wrote down a bunch of them. The first odd request I ever got was a lady came in with a peg leg for her dog. She had a three-legged dog, and genius veterinarian that she had made this dog a strap-on peg leg, and which made him mobile. And he was a very active dog, and he would wear this peg leg out. Well, after a few times, it started getting expensive, and she just came in the shop and asked if I could put some heel material on the bottom of her dog's peg leg. So for the next 4 or 5 years, that's what we did. He'd wear that heel material out, and then she'd bring it in, and we'd replace it for him.
I love that.
That was a neat one, yeah. We've done reenactment shoes for, you know, guys. There's a lot of guys that do American Revolution or Civil War reenactments, and they have footwear that matches that time period. So that was interesting. I think one of our favorites, though, is we had a customer who was in a club where it was a car club, and they all had Stutz Bearcat cars. And this fella, he wanted his reupholstered, and he had, he had it reupholstered, but his wife got mad at him. She didn't want that old upholstering taken out of that car. So what he did behind her back, he saved the old upholstering. He brought it in to my wife, and she made a tote, a woman's tote out of that material. And my gosh, it looked... This woman was so happy. It was unbelievable. So she had her Stutz Bearcat had new upholstery, and she got to keep the old upholstery, but she carried around as a bag.
Oh, man. And Deborah, your wife's been involved in this for a long time, too.
We've been working together since 1983. That's when we bought our first shop, yeah.
Oh, man. And you've obviously made a decent living out of this. Still, there's got to be some joys, and there's joys for sure. What are the joys of running a business in the North Woods?
Well, it's very comfortable up here for us. We feel at home here. My shop is in the woods, and we're set back, and it's quiet and peaceful. I look out the window, and my shop has windows, and I can look out the window, and I might see a bear walking by or a deer, or I might see some grouse up in the trees, or you just never know. And the people up here are just wonderful people. They appreciate men and women who work for a living, and they're thankful for us, and they've been a blessing to us, Larry. And as someone that's been doing this for 50 years, it's something that we don't have to do anymore, but I think we've got it pretty much figured out. And it's become easy. There's no stress. It's just a comfortable thing that we're doing. It's I enjoy it. I enjoy taking an old pair of shoes and making them new, or I enjoy taking a shoe where somebody needs a modification done to help them walk better. I enjoy that. That's a good feeling. And working with my hands, that's what I enjoy the most, I think.
Tell you what, next time I get to Rhinelander, I'm going to stop in and say hello, Dave. I thank you very much for taking some time to be with us today, and hopefully we can do this again. Thank you, Dave.
I appreciate you, Larry, and I had a great time. This half hour went by fast, I'm telling you.
It goes by really fast. Dave France.
Yeah.
Dave is owner of Lakeland Shoe Repair in Rhinelander. What a joy talking with him. And it's not only shoes, but he even does backpacks and gym bags. He'll repair those and a whole lot more. Thanks for joining us today. This and all our shows are a team effort. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, our producers, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our technical directors, and our executive producer, the poet Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.